It's hard for anybody to find a job right now, and if you've spent time behind bars, it is even harder. But in California, where more than 130,000 people leave state prisons every year, a number of nonprofits are finding it makes good business sense to hire ex-cons. Rachel Miro of member station KQED in San Francisco reports.
Steve Sims has done hard time more than once.
I went to prison back in 1986. I went to prison for robbery, possession of cocaine and stuff. And I ended up going to prison, coming back home, going back to prison, couldn't find a job, so started back doing what was natural, going back out there selling dope and stuff.
It was a merry-go-round Sims found hard to exit.
Part-time jobs here and there, here and there.
Then one day, Sims stopped by a local recycling center to drop off some stuff, and it occurred to him to ask inside for an application.
The next day, I got hired.
That was nearly 10 years ago, and he's still at Tri-Sed Community Recycling in Union City, a quiet suburb of the San Francisco Bay Area. Sims didn't know it at the time, but he landed a job at a place that makes a point of hiring people looking for a second chance, or a third, or a fourth. 25% of the people who work at Tri-Sed have a record, or they're at risk of getting one. That's not by happenstance, says CEO Richard Valle, who co-founded Tri-Sed nearly 30 years ago.
What we tried to create here was an opportunity for people to get back on track.
That starts with jobs that pay $9 an hour, but the possibilities rise from there, all the way to union gigs with Teamsters Local 70. As far as Valle is concerned, every possible task is an employment opportunity.
We're in the business of creating jobs, and so any little job that we can find, whether it's janitorial service inside the office or cutting the grass out in front, we do in-house.
Not every employer is so thoughtful, in large part because ex-cons have so much trouble finding work. More than two-thirds in California return to prison, the worst recidivism rate in the nation. Goodwill Industries of San Francisco, San Mateo, and Marin has made hiring ex-cons part of its main focus. 51% of the employees have a felony conviction.
We take people's discarded and unwanted goods, and we take society's discarded and unwanted people.
President and CEO Deborah Alvarez-Rodriguez spoke at a recent employment forum in Oakland, a city with a lot of parolees and 17% unemployment.
We have to move from job training and entry-level employment to transforming lives and creating solutions to poverty. And we have to put the marketplace at the center of what we're doing.
Her comments resonated with Mike Hannigan, who runs a for-profit office supply company called Give Something Back. Hannigan says a lot more firms could make use of government programs that offer subsidies and tax credits to companies that hire and train ex-cons. But he says too many employers fear the prospect of onerous paperwork.
That's why it's important for the programs themselves to come to the companies and say, these resources can make your company more productive and at the same time use your company as an employment opportunity for somebody who may have some barriers that are overcomable, but they need some help to get there.
Give Something Back is taking advantage of federal stimulus money channeled through California's Welfare to Work program that covers 80% of pay and training costs. Hannigan is using the subsidy to train truckers now, so they're ready to roll when the economy picks up in California. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Miro in San Francisco.
The rapper known as Lil Wayne recently pleaded guilty to attempted gun possession. He now joins the long list of rappers with criminal records. Youth Radio's King Anya Howell has followed Lil Wayne's career for years, and he considers the rapper's guilty plea a call to action.
If you listen to Lil Wayne's music, you'd believe he was campaigning for a prison conviction. And he got elected. What do fans say? MTV says fans think Lil Wayne's time behind bars won't hurt his career. Of course not. It's the fans themselves that encourage these federally funded vacations. It seems rappers who rhyme about the streets and criminal activity feel the need to have prison sentences on their rap resume. Think 50 Cent to T.I., Beanie Siegel to Gucci Mane. It's as though rappers are interviewing for the position of realist in rap. And fans make the choice. And they're less impressed by a rapper's ability to simply recite provocative rhymes. Oh, it says here you spent 3 years in San Quentin Correctional Facility for a weapons possession. Welcome aboard. Then, when artists are thrown in jail, for whatever reason, guilty or not, some fans architect these insane Free MC Thus and Such campaigns. In 2001, Bad Boy Records rapper Shine was sentenced to 10 years in prison for firing a gun inside of a crowded nightclub. Almost immediately, the Free Shine movement began. People wore Free Shine t-shirts in videos, photo shoots, and award shows. Now that Shine is free, the countdown has begun to his next album release. I agree, some rappers have spent time in prison for questionable charges and do need the support of the rap community. But I do have a big problem with just instantly making any old rapper out to be a political prisoner. It's time to remove these mandatory requirements from a rapper's resume. We need to stop encouraging and validating lawlessness. Stop buying the albums. And as far as rappers excusing themselves as musical actors of sorts, just playing characters, I'm calling cut. The role of cocaine kilogram distributing, crack rock cooking, trigger squeezing, prostitute pimping, misunderstood poet has been filled several times over. So as others prepare to start screaming, Free Lil Wayne, I'm gonna start the movement to Free Lil Wayne's Mind.
King Anya Howell's story was produced by Youth Radio.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Last month, NASA sent an empty rocket hull crashing into a dark, cold crater near the moon's south pole. The idea was to kick up the lunar dust to search for hidden stores of ice beneath. And today, NASA scientists announced they found evidence of water. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
The whole reason to smash a rocket part into this dark crater was that scientists thought water might be lurking down there in the form of ice. The impact last month created a hole about 60 to 100 feet wide and sent dust and debris soaring up. The plume was analyzed by instruments on an observing spacecraft, and that spacecraft sent the data back to Earth. Scientists have been studying it around the clock.
And so I'm here today to tell you that indeed, yes, we found water.
Anthony Colaprete is NASA's project scientist for this mission, called LCROSS.
And we didn't find just a little bit. We found a significant amount.
At a press conference, he held up a white plastic bucket. He said, in all the debris blasted out of the moon,
we found maybe about a dozen of these 2 gallon buckets worth of water.
The moon has been thought to be drier than the driest deserts here on Earth. But Colaprete calculates that the spot they hit is wetter than some of our deserts. Now that researchers know that ice is in the moon's dark craters, they want to figure out where it came from. Maybe from icy comets or from some kind of activity inside the moon. And NASA officials interested in human exploration say water is potentially a very handy resource for everything from drinking water to rocket fuel. Michael Wargo is chief lunar scientist for exploration at NASA headquarters.
That water could be the key to sustainability for exploration. So having it there is going to be extremely valuable to us, even if right now we can't go swimming in it.
NASA is currently aiming to send astronauts back to the moon by 2020, but President Obama's administration has been reconsidering those plans. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
The books of British writer Roald Dahl seem made for the movies with their chocolate factories and giant peaches. This weekend, there's a new movie based on one of his stories, The Fantastic Mr. Fox. Film critic Kenneth Turan has our review.
Fantastic Mr. Fox goes to your head like too much champagne, which is what you'd expect with George Clooney and Meryl Streep voicing Mr. and Mrs. Fox, the ultra-sophisticated Nick and Nora Charles of the forest world. The film follows the plot of the Roald Dahl book, which is a battle of wits between the larcenous title character and the combined forces of Bogus, Bunce, and Bean. They're not a law firm, but three of the meanest, nastiest, ugliest farmers in Mr. Fox's part of the world, and the richest. Mr. Fox swore off robbing these three once he and Mrs. Fox became parents, but he still has the yen. Working with Kylie the Possum, an old partner in crime, Mr. Fox plans that film noir movie staple, one last job that will set him up for life. Mrs. Fox, not surprisingly, is not amused when she catches them in the act.
Another book party?
Oh, I didn't see you sitting in the dark over there. Yeah, no, actually, there's a fire. I just got the call. They said maybe it's arson. I got to interview the marshal and see what's...
Kylie, is he telling the truth? If what I think is happening, it better not be.
As written by director Wes Anderson and Noah Baumbach, Fantastic Mr. Fox has been made in the painstaking process known as stop-motion animation that has brought all kinds of things to life. Stop-motion allowed Anderson to create his own very specific environment, complete with animal puppets that had real fur and an autumnal palette that had no use for the color green. "I'm a wild animal and a husband and father," our hero declares, and this movie succeeds because of its ability to strike the right balance between those poles.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times.
Now we go to Congresswoman Diana DeGette. She represents the 1st District of Colorado in the Congress. She is a Democrat. She's co-chair of the Congressional Pro-Choice Caucus. She's authored a letter that has been co-signed by more than 40 of her colleagues saying they will not support a final bill that includes the Stupak Amendment. And she joins us now by phone from her district. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Congresswoman, can I just ask you the same question I asked Julie? The supporters of the Stupak Amendment say that this just extends existing federal policy, and you say it goes further than that. Why do you say it goes further than that?
I really have to disagree with Julie in the scope of what this Stupak Amendment is, because I know Congressman Stupak has been saying all this does is apply the Hyde Amendment, but in fact it goes much, much further. What the Hyde Amendment says is, as you said, no federal funds shall be used to pay for abortions. That has been in the law for many years, and it's well established. The Pro-Choice Caucus doesn't really like it, but we accept it. You know, it's where we're at. And in fact, in my committee, the Energy and Commerce Committee, we put language into the bill, which was in the bill when it came to the floor, which preserved the Hyde Amendment. What the Stupak Amendment says is nobody in the exchange or in the public option can purchase an insurance plan that covers a full range of reproductive services, even with their own money. So, for example, the public option, now it's set up by the government, but it's not paid for by government funds. A middle-class businesswoman from Denver, for example, who's having trouble getting insurance now because she's a small business, might want to buy a plan with her own money, 100% her own money, in this public option. She would not be able to get a full range of reproductive care.
Well, there are those who say that these companies could offer a separate rider.
Well, I think the idea...
In the same way, for example, and not to trivialize the matter at all, but in the same way that in your home insurance, for example, you can buy a separate rider for valuable items like a wedding ring or something of that sort that isn't included in the core plan. They're saying it's the same thing.
That does trivialize it, mm-hmm. because, in fact, it's an unplanned pregnancy or a planned pregnancy that goes terribly wrong is never in anybody's planning. If you have a wedding ring, you know it might get stolen. You put a rider on your homeowner's policy. But, for example...
But when, why, I'm sorry, forgive me. Why couldn't someone reasonably anticipate people may or may not choose long-term care insurance. They may or may not choose other forms of insurance that are on riders. Are you saying that these companies would not offer these riders, or are you saying that people would not buy them?
I'm saying women would never buy them because they wouldn't think that they would have an unplanned pregnancy. It's just like saying you have to get a rider to buy cancer coverage or something like that. People don't plan on getting that. And we actually think, the Pro-Choice Caucus thinks, that we can have a resolution here. We're trying to be reasonable. What we're saying is we will agree to compromise to have the Hyde Amendment, but don't do an amendment that goes far beyond that and then say that's just the Hyde Amendment. And so we're still talking to people. We're still working with them on language. Something else, people say, well, in the exchange, if people get premium assistance, then they can't buy a plan with abortion coverage. But it's the same thing. Let's say you have $100 a month you're paying for your premium, and $10 is a subsidy, and $90 is your own money. We say you should be able to take your own money and apply that to a full policy. There's nothing in current law that prevents people from, with their own money, buying insurance.
And you're saying this amendment would, in your view, allow people from with their own. And finally, throughout the healthcare debate, as we have talked with lawmakers across the political spectrum, we have asked them, what is your bottom line? We asked, for example, House Majority Whip James Clyburn this question at the beginning of the week, and he said while he does not like this amendment, that he feels that the overriding goal of extending healthcare coverage to people who don't presently have it has to be the objective, and he would reluctantly vote for final passage, even if this amendment is included. What about you?
Well, I circulated a letter, and 41 people have signed it, saying this is too high a price to pay. If by some remote possibility the bill came back with this exact language in it, we would say take the bill off the table and go work on it. Now, having said that, I think we can come up with a compromise. In my committee, the Energy and Commerce Committee, we were able to come up with some compromise language that preserved the separation of federal funds in this legislation. And it's called the CAPS Amendment. And if people think that we can improve on that, if we can make it more clear that we're not going to spend federal money for abortions, we're happy to work with them on that, and we think we can. I've already talked to several senators this week who are working on it. But this particular amendment, it goes way farther than that. And that's what people need to understand. We're not trying to be unreasonable. We've compromised to keep the Hyde Amendment. This Stupak Amendment will prevent millions of women from getting legal medical services, and that's our concern.
Congresswoman, finally, if I could just press you one more time on this whole question of the rider. You're saying that people won't buy these riders if offered. People do buy riders for health care issues all the time. I mean, people now who buy individual policies on the open market can choose or choose not to buy coverage for maternity services, thinking they may or may not get pregnant. So why is this different?
Let me try it again. Mm-hmm. Unlike maternity services where you think, you know, I really might want to get pregnant and have a baby, people don't plan for an unwanted pregnancy. They don't plan to get pregnant when they didn't want to or to have a planned pregnancy that goes terribly wrong. And so they're not going to think, I better pay extra money every month in case this unplanned situation happens. And that's the problem with a rider.
And can I just
also, why should you have to do that with this one? You know, an abortion is a legal medical procedure, just like many other medical procedures. Why should you just single this one procedure out?
Congresswoman Diana DeGette of Colorado. She's co-chair of the Congressional Pro-Choice Caucus. She was kind enough to join us today by phone from her district. Congresswoman, we thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Blanc.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Now a tale of two brothers, but no ordinary brothers. One is Mark DiSanjo, who lives in China. The other is his half-brother, President Barack Obama. Just as the president is due to arrive in China, his half-brother has released a semi-autobiographical novel revealing the abusive nature of their father. In a rare interview, DiSanjo talked to NPR's Louisa Lim.
The eyes are familiar yet different. The face bears an uncanny resemblance to his more famous sibling. Mark Obama DiSanjo and Barack Obama share the same father. Barack Obama hardly knew their father, who left when Barack was just 2 years old. But his younger half-brother, Mark DiSanjo, grew up in Kenya under the same roof as their father.
He managed to work his way up through probably sheer intellect, will, and also at the same time, persistence to go to Harvard and some very high levels in American society. Then something happened. It was an explosive mixture of drink, maybe disappointment, and at the same time, an inability to understand his own demons that caused the domestic violence that we had in our home.
DiSanjo wrestles with that legacy in his semi-autobiographical book, Nairobi to Shenzhen. Like Mr. Obama, DiSanjo's mother was a white American, so the book describes his struggle with his multiracial identity. Like Mr. Obama, he went to university in the U.S., but his academic success was overshadowed by those formative years in Kenya.
With me, what happened is that I also didn't want anything to do with anything that had to do with my father. So this could include, for example, aspects of African culture. It could be, for example, you know, wanting to be associated with the Obama name.
After losing his marketing job in the U.S. after 9/11, DeSandro moved to China, where he took refuge in music and community work. A gifted pianist, he's heard here on an album he recorded. He volunteers at a local orphanage, and last year he married a Chinese woman. But he says Mr. Obama's election campaign turned his life upside down.
I didn't want anything to do with American politics. It's something that turns huge spotlights on everybody. But then what happened is slowly I began to see there's an atmosphere around the world that was moving from one which had been in fear towards one of hope.
DeSandro has been living in China for 7 years.
And the spotlight did indeed turn on DeSandro. Last year, he flew to Austin, Texas, using money he'd been saving to buy a piano to meet Mr. Obama for the first time in many years. He describes that moment.
Well, first I hugged him, and he looked at my mustache. He said, "Hey, what's this little thing here?" And then I said, it's a mustache, dude. And then he said, "Oh, you have a little less hair than the last time I saw you." And I said to him, "Well, so do you." And he said, "Oh, I couldn't afford a haircut then." It was so emotional.
His half-brother's election has allowed him to take pride in the Obama name, which he hadn't used for many years. Their father, who had six other children, died in a car crash in 1982. But for both men, his shadow looms large over their lives. Barack Obama described that influence in an NPR interview.
You know, there's a wonderful saying by Lyndon Johnson that, you know, every man is either trying to live up to his father's expectations or making up for his mistakes. And I think in some ways I still chase after his ghost a little bit.
That's interesting.
Does it apply to you too?
Well, I guess in my case, I don't see myself chasing after his ghost. I think for a long time his ghost was chasing after me.
DeSandro is planning to meet his half-brother on his trip to China, which starts this weekend.
I look at my brother and President Obama, and I am so totally proud of all that he's been able to do. I'm extremely excited my brother's coming to China.
In his autobiography, Dreams from My Father, Mr. Obama describes meeting Mark as being like looking into a foggy mirror. All these years later, DeSandro says he finally hopes to wipe clean the fog from that mirror. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.